Every day, tankers and pipelines carry black gold to power our industrial society. The coal trains and ships deliver more carbon for the great bonfire that is humanity's goal. We know for a certainty, if we keep on burning it all, our planet will become hot, stormy, ice-free, with dying oceans and extinction for most big species, including ourselves. Now the question, how much can we use before we tip the climate too far? This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith. Two new scientific papers published in the journal Nature at the end of April provide some answers, and it isn't pretty. So far, 100 nations have agreed on a limit to preserve a livable world. They say global warming should not exceed 2 degrees centigrade, that's about 3.6 degrees Fahrenheit, past the pre-industrial level before we began burning all this stuff. That's the global mean temperature, mind you, the average of all places, land and sea. We're approaching 1 degree of warming already. Some scientists, like NASA's James Hansen and V. Ramanathan of the Scripps Institution, say there is almost another 1.5 degree warming in the pipeline. That extra degree and a half is bound to come, they say, but hidden in the slow-release ocean and by short-lived smog. Many of us believe we are already past the dangerous tipping point, with positive feedback loops kicking in. But politicians and the global scientific community are still trying to design programs to keep atmospheric pollution within the 2-degree safe zone. The British journalist George Monbiot published an article in the UK Guardian newspaper on May 6, 2009, giving some handy figures about our carbon reserves and the projected releases of carbon dioxide. Find that link in my blog for May 21st at ecoshock.org. We'll go now to Potsdam, Germany, to one of the scientists working on this question. Their paper in Nature suggests humans are on course to surpass the safety limit projected for 2050, but will cross that dangerous boundary much faster, the way we are burning up fossil fuels now. We are now using the last of our fossil fuel allowance, driving to work or to the mall, lighting up patio heaters and empty streets. Bill Hare is an Australian climate scientist currently working at the Potsdam Institute in Germany. We speak to him from there. He was the lead author of the IPCC's Climate Change 2007 report, and now he is part of a team that has come out with some startling new calculations about the amount of carbon we can burn. Bill, could you just give us a little bit of a headline of why people, say, here in North America should be concerned with what your report says?
We've showed that to limit warming below 2 degrees above the pre-industrial level, which is accepted by and in fact called for by more than 100 countries around the world, that there is only a very limited amount of fossil fuels that we can burn and allow their carbon dioxide from that combustion to be emitted to the air. And that amount of fuel is far less than we would burn in the ordinary course of business. So, for example, we would burn through that budget at current rate of emissions in a little over 20 years. And our calculations are the first, I think, to introduce the full range of complexities and uncertainties in climate system science into these kinds of estimates of what are the allowable fossil fuel emissions over the next 50 years. So we think we've come up with quite a strong indication of actually what we can still burn and emit to the air and still limit warming below 2 degrees. And in fact, it's less than a quarter of the available, presently economically recoverable fossil fuel reserves.
Well, I think we all have the picture that we'll continue to drive around and continue to run our power plants as is, and then slowly make a transition towards the future, maybe with solar or whatever. But this report kind of says that isn't going to be possible, that we have to move much more quickly. How can we do this?
Well, it's true that on climate change, we are out of time. 20 years ago, when we first started really discussing action on climate change, then it was true that there was time remaining in order to make a slower transition to zero emission and more sustainable renewable energy systems. Now we have to make this transition a lot faster than we ever thought. But the good news is that I think the technologies are available to certainly begin that transition in a very big way, both on the supply side, that is on the energy production side, and on the consumption side. So on the renewable side, there's enormous potential for renewable energy systems to come into place quickly. At present, we're seeing an explosion of wind energy capacity globally and an extension of that technology beyond the old on a pylon on land approach to potentially offshore technologies that could produce enormous amounts of energy at a continental scale when combined with the new ideas of supergrids and so on. And there are many other renewable technologies that can come into play as well. And, of course, you also have exploration now of technologies that would capture carbon from power stations or from other kinds of fossil fuel burning facilities. And the so-called carbon capture and storage technologies are now under exploration, although I'm a bit skeptical about their ultimate potential, both environmentally and in an engineering sense. That remains to be seen. On the consumption side, I think that we see enormous potential for improvements in the efficiency with which we use energy in nearly everything that humanity does. And, of course, most of the emissions are coming from the richest part of the world, form of industry, automobiles, air traffic, and so on. So there are many ways in which we can quite rapidly reduce emissions, and I think also benefit economies at present. A rapid transition to cleaner technologies also means more investment and more jobs, ultimately, in economies that are suffering from the present recession. So there's an opportunity now to use the present economic downturn as a way of rebuilding our economic capacities in a wholly cleaner and greener way that would produce a much more environmentally and hopefully economically sustainable future development pattern.
One of the things that concerned me, I read in the press release from Nature magazine, or the journal really, the scientific journal where this will be published. In the press release it says we can only emit 1,000 billion tons of carbon dioxide between the years 2000 and 2050. The world has already emitted one-third of that in just 9 years. So we're not really going to leave much for the current generation or even the next generation to burn it all. It sounds like a very rapid shift has to happen.
Well, that's absolutely correct. And it's much faster than many in the academic policy community anticipated, and certainly in the political world. And you can see that as somehow bad news, which it is in an obvious sense. But on the good news side, we see technically and economically feasible ways of doing this that would produce economic benefits and non-economic benefits. The non-economic benefits being that if we make a fast transition away from fossil fuel-based power production that's emitting carbon to the air, then we also clean up a lot of air pollution problems, particularly in developing countries, that are causing a lot of damages to people and to agriculture. In other words, there's large economic co-benefits from a move away from dirty technologies as well. So it is technically and economically feasible. What we have on the other side of the equation are the legacy industries that are suffering and that will suffer from a rapid reduction in fossil fuel use, or that will have to pay more to eliminate emissions from their present use of fossil fuels. These industries are, in general, have long been opposed to action on climate change, and politicians in all continents have given these industries a lot of weight in the policy actions and processes in the past. If they continue to get the weight that they've had in the political discussions, then we will not solve this climate change problem, and we will create a first-order catastrophe for the world in the coming decade. This is also a very clear message from the science on the impact side. So I see it as a situation where we have little choice. And the challenge for us now is to turn necessity into a virtue by taking advantage of the need to rapidly introduce new and cleaner technologies to get new investment going that can create new jobs in industries that have been suffering the last year or two, in order to create a better and cleaner pattern of economic growth in the future.
I wanted to ask you about the sort of arbitrary 2-degree level as the safe. That's a 2-degree mean global temperature increase, and that's in centigrade. Would we still have polar ice caps, for example, at that level?
I wish there was a really clear answer to that. I think that based on our present generation of climate models, we should still have Arctic sea ice at 2 degrees, global mean temperature increase above the pre-industrial level. The observational evidence, that is the observed rate of loss of Arctic sea ice, both of its area and its thickness, implies another story, that there is a risk that this will be very much reduced or even gone at this level of warming. And I guess that points to the original question that you're asking, is what does this 2 degrees really mean? Is it safe or not? And I think the way to look at the 2 degrees limit that was first put forward by the European Union in 1996 is it's a bit like a traffic speed limit. It's not perfect. It's a pragmatic number that was chosen, taking into account a variety of considerations. And it won't protect the planet under all conditions, actually. From a scientific point of view, I would say one would need to look at substantially lower levels of warming in order to protect vital ecosystems and, in some cases, food production and so on. And I think that warming levels of 1.5 degrees or lower have been proposed by large numbers of countries, particularly the most affected countries, the small island states and least developed countries, as temperature limits that would maybe provide them with the opportunity for survival. Certainly on the sea level rise front, if you're going to limit warming, sea level rise to below a few meters, 2 degrees is certainly too hot in the long run. We would have to go down and return temperatures below present levels within a century or two in order to have a chance at limiting long-term sea level rise below 1 or 2 meters. And even then it wouldn't be guaranteed. So I think 2 degrees was a good starting point. Frankly, now I think it's the scientific evidence points, based on my own values, judgments about the worth of systems like coral reefs, rainforests, my assessment of risks to most vulnerable regions, is it's too warm for safety.
So I think you're not alone in that. I've heard some other scientists, including James Hansen, for example, saying the same things. Could you just, let's backtrack a little bit. Could you tell us who did this study and where it will be published and where people can find out more about it?
Well, the study has been led by my colleague, Malte Meinshausen, at the Potsdam Institute for Climate Impact Research. It was published in Nature on the 30th of April, and you can get it from the Nature website. And you can also get a question and answer that Malte and I prepared on the paper. You can find that from the Potsdam Institute website or from our model website, which is www.primap.org. That's www.primap.org. We have a question and answer on the paper there. The paper is a multi-author paper. Malte led the work. His brother, Nikolai, is a statistician at Oxford University now, and he was involved intimately in the design of the statistical analyses that lies behind the conclusions that we reached. And myself and other authors helped with different parts of the work. So Malte and Nikolai are really the leaders of this paper in the scientific sense, and others such as myself have helped with the work either in the design of the research or in particular areas of the analysis. It's a very rich paper in the sense that it's very complicated. And I'm not sure if you asked any individual author, including Malte, whether they could fully explain it all, you would get 100% answer. But that's the nature of these kinds of papers. They are very dense, very complicated, and call upon a range of skills in the physical and mathematical sciences.
Another thing that's in the press release, it says if we continue burning fossil fuels as we do, we will have exhausted the carbon budget in merely 20 years, and global warming will go well beyond 2 degrees. So I'm trying to picture we have an economic downturn. Perhaps we'll lower our emissions a little bit just because we can't do any more. But this would project a world by 2035, which is not that far away, 25 years from now, say, where there are no carbon or fossil fuels burned because we've made the switch. I mean, that's how fast we have to make it. Is that what you're saying?
I don't believe it's feasible to eliminate carbon emissions by 2035, but it's certainly feasible to reduce them to quite low levels on that time frame and to reduce them by much more than 70% by 2050. I think that's certainly believable, technically and economically. If we delay before we start reducing, though, we rapidly run out of the carbon budget. So, you know, every 5 years of delay in peaking emissions globally increases dramatically the rate of reduction that is actually required to keep emissions within this budget. So if we peaked global emissions by around 2015, then we would need to be reducing emissions by around 3.5% per year to 2015. And if we peaked emissions in 2020, we would need to be reducing at 6% a year, which I would say is already lying somewhat outside what we see coming from models that show what is technically and economically feasible to be achieved. So that's why there's such enormous pressure now on this Copenhagen negotiation at the end of this year to agree the framework and actions that we can all take in order to bring about a halt to the global growth of emissions. And after that happens, to begin reducing them quickly.
I know that you were a lead author in the 2007 IPCC report, and I went back, and at that time it seemed like you were a little optimistic in interviews with BBC and others that, well, we knew what was happening and we could get a plan here to make these changes. This report, to me, from what I've seen so far, seems a little more somber about our chances and a little more urgent about what we have to do. What's changed in those 2 years?
I guess that the thing that's changing a lot, in this, you know, not just for me, but for many scientists, is the realization of the scale of the problem that we've got with the impacts of climate change. Things are happening a lot faster than we would have expected them to. And I think that whereas before many saw the impacts of climate change like a distant mountain range on the horizon, now we can see this mountain range directly in front of us. And it's very high, and its scale is frightening to many. So there's a feeling that of urgency about the rate of required action that, whilst it was there a few years ago, is now becoming more prominent in people's minds. I think the economic analysis that we described in the 2007, the fourth assessment report of the IPCC, remains valid and is lying behind my comments today that it is technically and economically feasible to make the rates of emission reductions required to stay within this budget. You know, this is based on our assessment in the fourth assessment report. This remains as valid now as it was when we finished the report. And indeed, since the fourth assessment report was concluded, there's been a handful of additional studies done on what we call low scenarios, that is, scenarios that limit greenhouse gas concentrations to low enough levels to give us a high chance of meeting 2 degrees. And these all confirm that it's technically and economically feasible to do so and that the costs are not high. And in one model case, actually produces a benefit to the global economy.
So we could do it and we could benefit from it. Is there anything that you would like to add for our listeners as we wrap up?
I think that's quite a lot I've said. That's enough.
Okay. Well, thank you so much, Bill Hare, from the Potsdam Institute in Germany, for talking with us today about our new challenges in climate change.
Thank you, Alex.
Climate stress pounds our cities in different ways. California gets fires, drought, and draining water supplies. The southern U.S. cities and even those in the northeast, like New York, fear another great hurricane. In the middle, floods and ice storms have already hit the headlines, all against the backdrop of moving climate zones impacting wildlife and agriculture and your food supplies. The way your city is run could impact how well you survive, or whether you become another urban refugee. That's why I take the time to record local leaders for livable cities, people like Portland's new mayor, Sam Adams. Grist.org just ran a feature May 1st on the 15 green-leaning mayors in America. They included people like Michael Bloomberg from New York City, Greg Nickels of Seattle, San Francisco's Gavin Newsom, and even Richard Daley in Chicago. There is Shirley Franklin in Atlanta, the mayor of Salt Lake City, Ralph Becker, and even the gruff mayor of Jersey City, Jeremiah Healy. But Grist missed one of the greenest of them all, Sam Adams, the mayor of Portland. We're here to rectify that. Radio EcoShock was out to record Sam at an event in Vancouver, April 24, 2009. This was part of a hot new city series called Shifting Gears, presented by two universities in Vancouver, Simon Fraser and the University of British Columbia. Sam was introduced by UBC planner Larry Frank, a man who doesn't just theorize. As the Bombardier chair, Frank measures and tests how humans really use their cities and towns. In fact, I'm going to give you a quick rundown on the top city-saving speeches at our site, ecoshock.org. One of the Shifting Gears speeches no one should miss is called Resilient Cities, Responding to Peak Oil and Climate Change. That was the kickoff book lecture by Australian expert Dr. Peter Newman. As oil declines and climate goes weird, he acknowledges the possibility of a Mad Max social chaos, or armed eco-barracks for the rich, maybe, but Newman sees a real way to make sustainable cities. It's realistic, and it's a hopeful speech at SFU Vancouver, found in the Radio EcoShock show January 16th, 2009. Just look in our program archives at ecoshock.org for the free MP3 download. Another biggie with surprising good ideas to survive the peak oil threat is Transport Revolutions, Moving People and Freight Without Oil. That's by Richard Gilbert and Anthony Pearl. How new oil economy reshapes air, road, rail, and shipping towards sustainable power. Look in our 2008 archives for the EcoShock show March 28, 2008. Finally, there's our program June 6, 2008 called Building Madness. Buildings emit 48% of the fossil CO2, killing the climate. You'll hear six voices on cities, eco-density, green architecture, and city fascism. Anthony Pearl, Richard Register, Larry Franks again, Sir Norman Foster, Derek Jensen, Al Gore, and Guido Wimmers. This show includes hard info on Israeli electric cars and why suburbs make people fat. That's the June 6, 2008 EcoShock show at ecoshock.org. And don't miss our interview with Clive Doucette on urban meltdown. Some cities, from Michigan to California, are already breaking down. People flee unworkable cities, and they head towards refuge cities, like Portland. Clive Doucette's interview is in the April 24, 2009 EcoShock show. What makes Portland so green, such a pleasant place to live? For one thing, years ago, city leaders decided to limit the area Portland could cover. They set boundaries that prevented endless suburban sprawl, and it encouraged density near mass transit. Portland has one of the highest bicycle riderships in the country. They don't just use streetcars. Portland makes them to sell all over the nation, just part of the new green economy. There are things that will preserve your city or town. So let's tune in to Sam Adams, recorded April 24th in Vancouver.
Tonight, I'm going to show you some slides. I'm going to talk about some approaches that were taken in the city of Portland. I was sworn in on January 1st of this year. I was elected in the primary election. So I've had time, to sort of work on an agenda. I'm working on a 100-day agenda as mayor of the city of Portland, the 55th mayor of the city of Portland. But tonight is really about sharing with you, and I look forward to the questions. And I'm really working to organize Portland to build, to learn the lessons that we need to learn to accept both the realities, but to be inspired and creative in our decision-making. And our organizing principle for Portland that is sort of on the table right now for discussion as we look to put together the Portland Plan, which is the plan for Portland's next 25 years, is really around this concept of 20-minute neighborhoods. connected by, you know, green and multimodal corridors that are intended to not just, you know, create sort of satisfaction, a deep level of satisfaction with Portlanders, but also to do well in terms of our impact on the climate and create economic opportunities for more Portlanders and to create prosperity for more Portlanders. So the concept of 20-minute neighborhoods connected by green, multimodal networks, multimodal corridor, network of corridors. How many have been to Portland before? Oh, well, why am I up here? Crying out loud. All right. Well, this will be really good discussion then. This is Portland. It's a great city. You must come visit. We don't have a sales tax. Spend lots of money. Don't rent a car. We're working hard to make it possible to live in Portland and to visit Portland in a manner that you don't need a car. We're 143 square miles. We are surrounded by, I'll talk a little bit more in a minute, we're surrounded by an urban growth boundary. 70 miles of our 143 square miles are pervious pavement. And you see the red, the redder it is, the more pervious pavement we have here. We are a city of six watersheds, and we're considered one of the most livable cities in the United States, one of the most environmental friendly cities in the United States, one of the environmental conscious cities in the United States, and yet our watersheds, we have six of them, all in terms of health, all get a failing grade. Part of the reason that we succeed, that we're rated number one, the number one most sustainable city consistently in the United States, is a couple of reasons. One, we've worked hard at it. Long before I was in positions of influence, a lot of other people worked hard at it. And back in the 70s with Senate Bill 100, we established a very robust definition of the common good. And by common good, it means that you don't get to do everything you want just because you own a piece of property, and that we were going to draw a line around ourselves and protect farm and forest land. So Portland and Oregon, Washington, Idaho has always been sort of this quirky city and a quirky part of the United States. We were simultaneously governed by Britain and the United States for 60 years. And if you were British, you followed British law. And if you were an American, you followed American law. And it didn't matter if you lived next door to each other. That's what you did. And a lot of people speculate that out of that dysfunction came this idea that we just sort of see things differently and we allow others to see things differently. And so in the 1970s, it was really out of a concern to protect farm and forest land that folks before me established this urban growth boundary for which we are not allowed to grow beyond, except under certain conditions, and the nation's strongest, toughest land use laws. We're a city of about 570,000 people. In terms of planning, we've really tried to, as you have, focus along corridors, protecting single-family neighborhoods and focusing growth in the areas along transit corridors or transit-appropriate corridors for future transit. And show folks the amenities that go along with that. All right, multimodalism, tough word to pronounce, but it is what we believe in Portland. The American culture is marinated with a love for the car, a love for the automobile. A lot of our economy is wrapped up in a successful domestic automobile industry, which right now is, you know, in pretty bad shape. So I think enlightened leaders in the United States do not try to get Americans to consider taking trips other than driving alone in their car. We do not seek to do that by making Americans feel guilty. Instead, we try to provide them options that they actually want to act on in terms of one or more of their trips in a given day, week, or month. And so in terms of multimodalism, the idea, and that's the notion of networks and of corridors that connect 20-minute neighborhoods, is really key to what I see and others see for the future of Portland. What's a 20-minute neighborhood? A 20-minute neighborhood means that you can get what you need and want on a daily basis and a weekly basis within a 20-minute, a 20-minute walk or bike ride from your home. And we're in the process right now of analyzing how many of our homes fall into the category right now of a 20-minute neighborhood. Portland, as is Vancouver, is a city that was built around streetcar system. And so the corner grocery store without parking, that actually carries what you would want to buy on a daily and weekly basis, a corner grocery store that does not have parking, that is in your neighborhood, that carries what you actually want to buy at a price that you think is comparable to driving across town to a bigger box or to some other kind of grocery store, is key to the 20-minute neighborhood. And what does that mean? As transportation commissioner for the city of Portland, and we have a strange form of government, I'm an elected transportation commissioner and also mayor, it means that maybe perhaps the best transportation investment I could make would be to procure a grocery store site, maybe in an old house on the corner like they used to be, and some still do exist in the city of Portland, to make sure that the rental costs of that site allow for a successful business, to make sure that the surrounding 20 minutes walking distance and biking distance from that corner grocery store in the old house on the corner, that we invest in a market analysis of what those folks actually want to buy, and that we might actually consider subsidizing the cost of making sure that the goods that the folks that live around that old-timey grocery store can procure those items, again, what they want at a price that they think is fair and commensurate with the across-town grocery store competitors. That might be the best possible transportation investment for the city of Portland. Strange, isn't it? A transportation department that does a consumer market analysis that might be obtaining a lease or a rental agreement for an old, you know, dwelling on a corner somewhere without parking, that would be subsidizing the rent of a private operator to provide amenities, basic consumer amenities, that might be a staging point for the drop-off of boxes and FedEx and your laundry. That might be one of the best transportation investments that Portland might make. You're right. It is. Could be. Two-thirds of Portland's trips are not about driving from home to work. Two-thirds of our trips are not about driving home to work. Most of those trips are about procuring stuff. My transportation department is, their eyes spin when I talk like this, let me tell you.
This is Radio EcoShock. You are listening to a speech about livable cities by one of America's greenest mayors, Sam Adams of Portland.
All right. What needs to connect those 20-minute neighborhoods? We're not going to have a streetcar. We call them streetcars. They're called trams. That's in the upper right. The lower right are light, or what we call light rail. Not every little grocery store is going to be connected by a streetcar or light rail. We just don't have the money, and it would be the wrong kind of connections to make. But neighborhoods in the city of Portland over the next 25 years will be connected by streetcar and light rail. The light rail corridors are those corridors that when you look beyond the city limits of Portland, when we need to connect the corridors beyond the city of Portland, those are the corridors that will be prioritized for light rail. Within the city of Portland, those are the corridors that will be connected by streetcar. I'll talk a little bit more about streetcar. We spent $125 million on 8 miles of streetcar during the George Bush years. There was no federal funding for streetcar. Then we had a local congressman who got legislation passed through the U.S. Congress that created a whole new pot of money to fund local streetcar projects. And the Bush administration wouldn't let any of that money out of that fund for streetcars. So we spent $125 million in local money. We raised on-street parking meter revenues. We raised the public garage parking fees. And we used that money and what we call tax increment money to put together a pool of funding of about $125 million through the central city of Portland. And it is some of the best investment, some of the best money we ever spent. Because within three blocks of that 8 mile stretch of streetcar, we had $3.5 billion in private investment. In fact, 55% of all the new housing in the central city of Portland happened within those three blocks of streetcar. Light rail stops about every 2 miles. It moves people fast, and it's good for connecting a region. Streetcar stops every 2 miles, and it's good for creating the kind of activated landscape that we want, activated streetscape that we want, and it's good for, it's development-oriented transit. Nothing else that we spend money on gets the kind of private sector response as streetcar does. Transit ridership in the city of Portland since 1989, when we got serious about it, is up 100% when we got serious. We have hills like you have hills. We connected it with a tram, probably the most controversial transit investment the city of Portland ever made. Initially, it was estimated to cost $15 million. The actual price of construction came in at $57 million. I would not recommend that you do a lot of these. I know you have some. You have one already. And it has unlocked redevelopment opportunities that we couldn't have done any other way. It is a corridor in the air between a hill where our major research and university hospital is, down near the water. Upper left shows that you can barely see the in the upper left. That was all abandoned industrial area that now becomes an extension of our university research hospital. So for that, it has been a fantastic thing. But it has also proven to be very expensive. Why do we think about 20-minute neighborhoods? Why do we think about having them connected with these green multimodal corridors? Regional rail is another example. I don't know who that guy is on the right. He looks like a real boy. In part, We were thinking this way because we've done a lot of research in the last 3 years. Portland has the highest per capita trips by bicycle than any city in the United States. And yet, we're at about 5% citywide. In the downtown retail district, the central business core, it's about 12%. And every time we expand the bike network, we see an exponential increase in bike riders. You expand it a mile, you know, and you'll see, you know, a 300% increase in biking. We spend a lot of time in Europe. We're about to build our first cycle tracks, if you know what those are. And I have a proposal for $24 million to build 110 miles of bike boulevards. And the reason that I would, even though everyone's cutting budgets, I'm proposing to spend $24 million on 110 miles of bike boulevards is that we've done, as I mentioned, a lot of polling and a lot of research. And when we ask Portlanders, and again, Portland is one of the most liberal cities in the United States, where people describe us as the People's Republic of Portland. We had more people vote for Obama as a percentage than I think any other major city in the United States. We had the largest rally for Obama. I mean, we're liberal. We're progressive. But we still only have 5% of our trips by bicycle. You know, that's, you know, and we go to Copenhagen and we go to Stockholm and, you know, they sneer at us because, you know, they have, you know, I don't know, 90% of all their trips have ride bikes, or one would believe that, you know, by their attitude. And, and I love them and it's wonderful, but I just want to get our bike ridership up. So we spent a lot of money and time over the past 3 years asking Portlanders that don't ride their bikes what it would take. At the same time, I'm looking to put a ballot measure on the ballot that would try to increase funding for transportation. And we gave him a list of 27 items if we had more money that we could invest in. At the very, very bottom in the People's Republic of Portland was, not him, sorry, was spend more money on bikes and spend more money on freight. And it really hurt the feelings of both the freight advocates and the bike advocates that they were vying for the bottom of the public's sort of priority list. And it kind of flummoxed a bunch of us because in the focus groups we did, we asked folks, what do they think makes Portland unique? And they talked about the bike culture and they talked about that light rail and streetcar. And so it was strange that it would be ranked so low. And yet in the focus groups, it seemed to be, even by non-bike riders, even by non-transit riders, to be sort of a part of what makes Portland quirky and unique. And then we asked a question. We did more research and found out that, we asked the question if, in terms of the 27 items, we went back and asked a different list. And one of the items on the list was, would you invest more money in bike boulevards, what you, I think you call bikeways, in bike boulevards? That's the quiet adjacent street to the really busy streets that prioritize for bicyclists. It includes barricades so bikes can go through but cars cannot go through. I mean, a really good system of getting, you know, still having the bike lanes on the busy streets for the last block or two blocks, but bike boulevards. We asked Portlanders if they would spend more money on removing the conflict between the bikes and the cars by investing in these bike boulevards. And it came out number three. After fixing two bridges across our main river that are rated really low, you know, among the lowest, it came out basically after the bridges as the top item that Portlanders wanted to fund. And the lesson for us there was that people that drive cars exclusively are scared to death that they're going to hit a bicyclist. And people that don't ride bikes are scared to death that they're going to be hit by the cars. Both of them want the same thing. They want to see more bikers on the quieter streets. Again, we're not going to shift our bike infrastructure off the busy streets because that's important as well, but we're going to get more bike riders if we expand our bike boulevard network, and that's what we're going to do here. This is the bike boulevard network that we're building in the city of Portland. And again, it's some of the best investments in transportation infrastructure I can get away with. And I've got, you know, the city of the Portland region is the third most trade-dependent city in the United States, which means that with our port, our inland port, we're very dependent on freight, so I have to invest a lot in freight to keep freight moving quickly. But in terms of reducing congestion and making sure that, you know, that people have healthy options and reliable trip times and affordable ways of mobility, the bicycle network that we're building here in terms of lanes, boulevards, and trails, that is a high priority for me. And even if you never get on a bike in the city of Portland, Oregon, you should be very, very supportive of our investment in these areas because it reduces congestion and air pollution and keeps your neighbors healthy. So that's part of that corridor, that multimodal sort of network of corridors that we're seeking to connect between our 20-minute neighborhoods. We like to... We have 20,000 people in our bridge pedal every year, and we use this shamelessly as a way to get the... There's a big percentage of people. We shut down the eight bridges or parts of the eight bridges in the city of Portland every year, and it's our shameless way to get people out. There's a high percentage of people that bike once a year at this bridge pedal. once a year. And we shamelessly use it as a way to get more information and also to market them on the bike and pedestrian option and transit options to and from their neighborhoods. Our Smart Trips options, which are built on the best practices in Australia, is a door-to-door effort that is like a concierge for folks that have never considered or been afraid to consider or didn't think it was realistic for a variety of reasons to consider anything other than driving to work and back or to get their basic necessities, entertainment, or what their mobility requirements in the city of Portland are except any other way except driving alone. We've had a lot of success on that, and we use our bridge pedal as a way to market to those folks. I'd like to remind Portlanders that our accomplishments in the area of climate change, our accomplishments in the area of sustainability should inspire us to do more. And we get written up a lot in the national press, and I'm, on behalf of Portlanders, very proud of that, although I remind Portlanders we need to be very humble because within the United States that is high praise on an incredibly low standard, very low standard. We have not had a federal government that has prioritized transit investments, that have cared much about cities, much less about bikes and pedestrian issues. We had to have had to fight and claw our way to, when we get these dollars, to invest them in projects that are intended most always for the car. And so as good as Portland is, and I'm proud to be the mayor of Portland, it is high praise on a very low standard, and we need to be humble in that knowledge and keep pushing forward. Portland was one of the first cities in the United States to establish a climate action plan to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, not by me, but by a predecessor on the Portland City Council, and we're one of the few cities in the United States and the world that has actually not only reduced our per capita emissions of greenhouse gas, but have actually reduced our greenhouse gas emissions by 1% based on 1990 levels. We've done that in the same way that you do a lot of your best work up here in terms of focusing on complete neighborhoods, density, compact growth, mixed-use neighborhoods, mixed-income neighborhoods. We spend a lot of money on affordable housing. We've now just last week set a new goal for ourselves that I think we join in the goals that have already been set by Seattle, San Francisco, and your city. It's exciting to be able to consider more aggressive reductions in greenhouse gas and more positive aspirations on climate change with the new administration that not only has that actually believes that climate change is a real risk, but actually knows on the, again, the U.S. federal level that cities do exist and that they need some focus and they need some investments. The last 8 years of the Bush administration have been incredibly punishing on the issues of sustainability, but they've also been incredibly punishing for cities. And it's nice to have a new president that knows the importance of both cities and the need to focus on this. This is our goal. By 2050, an 80% reduction in emissions. And by 2030, our interim goal is 40%. We have 2030 objectives and 2012 objectives that are very concrete. We're out for 3 months of public comment. You can go to mayorsamadams.com to download the science behind it and to download the draft objectives. We're about to hold 12 town halls throughout Portland that will go over each of the 8 action areas. And what's been important to me as you talk about, again, about the 20-minute neighborhoods and the corridors of multimodal, green corridors of multimodal connections is to get it down to the individual neighborhood level, to get it down to the individual household level eventually, but at least the neighborhood level and the business district level, so that everyone in Portland knows how we're doing in terms of the geographic areas of the city. 2003 household expenditures, and this is the added benefit, 2003 household expenditures on transportation by metropolitan area, the city of Portland spends about less than 20% than the average city in the United States on transportation. Again, it goes back to, I don't try to browbeat people or guilt people, guilt trip Portlanders into, you know, carry your reusable bag, never use your car, you know, wear a hair shirt, don't take a bath, you know, reduce the carbon footprint. And at least in my country, you don't get very far with that. But what I can pitch them on to get to the same goal, and again, consistent with the climate action plan, is I can save you money. And I can make Portland more economically competitive with the approaches that I've talked about tonight and that you here in Vancouver are seeking to implement. Portland spends about 20... Portland drives in their car about 20% less than most, than the average big cities in the United States. And that leads to a citywide reduction, regionwide reduction of about $800 million that we don't spend on cars. Portland doesn't manufacture cars. We don't have oil wells. We don't, we're not the headquarters for a lot of auto insurance companies. And so Portlanders spend a net $800 million every year less than the average American city. That's money in the pockets of Portland households, and that makes the money that $800 million that is spent on other things than the car, it makes Portland's economy that much more resilient. It circulates in the local economy. Every dollar spent in the local economy returns 64 cents versus a dollar spent on things like cars, which is, I think it's about 37 cents. So the way I approach these issues is there's a certain percentage of the population that will get the green message and just go with it, and that's all they need. But there's a bigger percentage of the population where I need to make a number of different arguments, again, to realize this notion that Portlanders can have as good or better life than they have now. They can be more prosperous than they are right now. They can be healthier, and they can have a better neighborhood than they have right now. And that's with this approach of a 20-minute neighborhood and the multimodal corridor connections. In the end, Portlanders value their quality of life very, very much, just like you do here in Vancouver. And that's what we work on, not only, and we're working, you know, to translate that into satisfaction. So the numbers are good in terms of prosperity. The numbers are good in terms of, you know, reduction in carbon emissions and all this stuff. But in the end, it's about quality of life. And that's really speaking to people sort of where they're at right now and speaking to them in terms and motivating them in terms that seems very meaningful to them.
That was Sam Adams, Mayor of Portland, recorded at a Shifting Gears event, sponsored in part by the University of British Columbia and Simon Fraser University. Sam is part of a club of green mayors growing up all over the United States and Canada. Despite the collapse of municipal bond markets now and falling tax revenues, it still looks like local action is the only way forward. That means you and me. Planning meetings and local politics used to be as boring as dishwater, but now it's the best route to survivable towns and to cities that are safe for humans. I hope you will get active where you live. I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. Find links to all the resources mentioned in this program in my blog entry for May 14th, 2009. As we wrap up, I don't want to forget the millions of people now out of work. The latest American estimates I've seen, there are about 25 million people cast out or left out of meaningful employment. Millions will become homeless, and somehow, we need to look after and reintegrate all our good people. So I'll play you a clip from the Q&A following Sam Adams' speech in Vancouver, where he talks about the homeless challenge, and you can get that whole Q&A on the city's page from ecoshock.org. Then we'll close out with a song that touched me, from the album Don't Be Afraid of the Dark, the Robert Cray Band with Night Patrol. Thank you for listening.
Thank you for the question. I had a chance to have lunch with your mayor, and he was talking how this was a priority for him and the frustrations that he had about a sort of provincial and federal or national sort of disinvestment and in this issue, and how he's sort of left with sort of dealing with it on the street with not a lot of resources. And that's how a lot of cities in the United States have felt as well. We have a 10-year plan to end homelessness, and a couple of sort of key parts of that is that we're 3 years into it. We've gotten, I think the number is up to almost 500 chronically homeless people, people that have been homeless and on the streets for, I think, I'm going to get this exactly wrong, but I think it's like 2 or more years, you know, that are in permanent supportive housing, that are dealing with whatever issues they needed to deal with to get into sort of that stable and permanent with supportive housing. And I think the message is, and you probably already know this, is that you as a community are going to pay one way or another. The question is, do you want to do it more efficiently, more humanely, more compassionately, you do it up front. Some of the changes we made included, we don't, you know, it used to be that we felt, I think the community sort of felt very pious as you couldn't get through the door of a homeless shelter if, you know, you were visibly intoxicated or on drugs or had mental health issues. And, you know, that made us feel really good. You know, you clean up your act and then you can stop being homeless. We changed that policy, and we saw an immediate benefit, because if we can get them through the door, if we can get folks through the door, some folks are just down on their luck, you know, get them through the door, establish relationships, establish trust, we can start moving them into supportive housing, supportive programs, regardless of whether they happen to be using or addled in whatever way at that particular moment. So we saw a big improvement there. Next week I'll be announcing my proposed budget for the city, and I'll be announcing a major new investment that's called for in the 10-year plan to end homelessness, and that's a resource access center for folks that identify themselves as homeless that really includes a component with a lot of outreach. The other thing that we found in our 10-year plan to end homelessness is to go where people are sleeping, to go to where people are hanging out, and not wait for them to come to us. We've got a number of grassroots, community-based organizations that have had a lot of success at establishing those relationships out in the street, and a lot of those people have come in from the cold.
See him huddled in the shadows, sleeping on his cardboard bed, using rags for a pillow, where he lays his unwashed head. His blankets, old newspapers, they're not much good against the snow. You see so many out there like him, when you walk the night patrol. When you walk the night patrol, oh, you wonder where he came from, where he's gonna go. Was it a woman or a bottle that's brought him down so low? What's happened to his